Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Steven Spielberg's 1991 film Hook. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Hook, where's the hook?
Joining us also is the movies editor for Hollywood.com, Matt Patches. Thanks so much for coming back on the Not Just New Movies podcast.
I prefer to be referred to as Rufio.
Rufio Patches. See if we can turn that into a thing.
Yay.
So if you guys are just joining us for the first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So, I've got the character name game for this week. I'm going to do it a little bit differently because not a ton came out. I mean, you got Woman in Black and Chronicle, basically, are the kind of the two big releases.
Movie?
It is, yes. And so, normally the way we do this is I'll give you guys a character name and you have to guess what movie the character's from. Now I'm going to give you a character name, and you have to guess what TV show the character is from.
I know.
Okay. But it does feature one of the people.
It's a Golden Girl, Matt. One of the four Golden Girls.
One of the people who stars in either Woman in Black or Chronicle is this character. So there's a hint there. So the name is Vince Howard. Vince Howard. So if you guys can think of any TV shows, we'll get back to that at the end of the episode today. So let's go ahead and move into the media consume section. So the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching, any sort of cool events we've attended lately, concerts, books we've read, anything of that sort. Matt, I know that you and I just got back from the Sundance Film Festival recently, but have you had any time in the kind of week of recovery to actually watch or consume any sort of media?
I did. I had to go straight from Sundance to see Woman in Black.
Okay.
For this week to review that for Hollywood.com.
All right.
But I decided to also follow it up swiftly with another movie that I missed from last year called Insidious, which I believe debuted at the South by Southwest Festival last year, which I just continually could not catch it. So that movie Insidious is now on Netflix streaming. And I decided to follow up Woman in Black with that movie because they're both kind of haunted house, you know, what's spooky, what's happening in this crazy place. Mm-hmm. And they're very similar in that it's a lot of just kind of wandering around watching jump scares happen and like creaky doors opening.
Mm-hmm.
Woman in Black, I'm trying to decide which one's actually worse. That's never a good sign. Well, Woman in Black is just extremely boring because it really is Daniel Radcliffe wandering around an elegantly beautiful house. I mean, this the design of this house, it takes place in the early 1900s, and it's a beautiful, beautiful set. Unfortunately, it's not beautiful enough to just watch Daniel Radcliffe wander around it for 90 minutes.
That was kind of how I felt about Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Did you see that?
I did not get to see that. Is that another haunted house movie? I thought that had more going on.
There's a little bit more going on. There's like tiny creatures in the basement.
I was about to say, it's haunted by imps or something.
Yeah. But that's another one where the house and the set is really gorgeous, but not really a ton happens, and all the characters are really stupid, and just everything about the movie is just really kind of boring and doesn't really make a ton of sense.
Yeah, and in Woman in Black, he keeps wanting to leave the house. Like, he leaves the house and goes to the town, and everyone's like, leave, you have to leave. You're getting, all the children are dying because you keep going back to the house. And he's like, well, okay, then he goes back to the house. And then more children die, and he doesn't really take a hint. So it's a little annoying in that respect. But so I was hoping for something more interesting from Insidious, directed by James Wan, who did Saw, the mm-hmm. original Saw movie, and his writing partner Lee Whannell, who was in Saw, I believe, as an actor, and is also in Insidious as like a paranormal investigator. I for some reason I thought they could cook up something really interesting, but really it's just another haunted house jump scare movie shot gorgeously on the Red camera.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like digital. It is. But this movie is really just kind of tedious jump scare after jump scare. And then the third act turn, the explanation for why they're haunted is so ridiculous. It just doesn't make any sense. And again, I don't know why I'm learning a lot about the horror genre recently. I feel like I've never really been that interested in it because it all seems so conventional. It seems like they keep retreading the same tropes from all these movies, and I'm waiting for someone to really break out. And, you know, to break out with a haunted house movie, I think all you have to do is drop the music. Because these people can come up with really interesting ways of shooting scary moments and kind of peppering them throughout the movie and really conjuring up true fear. But then they overlay it with this, like, da-da-da.
Yeah.
Score, and it ruins everything. And Insidious does the same thing, plus has a mind-boggling. Like, I totally get that they wanted to do something crazy different than just have a haunted house. But what they do is ridiculous and not set up and not interesting. And it's just insane.
Yeah. Did you, at last year's Sundance, did you get a chance to see that movie Safe House with, or no, I'm sorry, not Safe House, Silent House with Elizabeth Olsen? Okay.
Which is about to come out. They did that in all of one shot. That's from the people who did Open Water.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, because it's all in one shot, if they're going to do that thing you're talking about where they drop the music. That might be interesting. I think I'm going to get to see a screening of that this week, but they don't want it reviewed until, like, the beginning of March or something.
Yeah,
so,
the reactions out of Sundance last year were so-so, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. This was before Elizabeth Olsen was, like, the wunderkind, you know, new ingenue of Sundance with Martha Marcy May Marlene. This one kind of gets swept under the rug, but I have high hopes. I want to see – I think haunted house movies are fun. And they should have great scares. And, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, I can understand why he wanted to do this movie. He plays a guy in his early 20s who has, like, a four-year-old child and a wife, and he seems very mature in the film. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the story is just such a bore. It was written by Jane Goldman, who wrote Kick-Ass and
maybe some of X-Men First Class.
Yeah, and it's just so lame. Like, it's just not... None of the characters are very interesting, and the scenarios are not lively. Mm. You know, they're dead. So really disappointed week for haunted house movies, unfortunately. Okay. But I know Insidious has a lot of defenders, and it's also they just greenlit a sequel.
Yeah.
Which should be equally ridiculous. So.
What do you think about that? Do you think this sequel has any chance of, like, clarifying some of the stuff that happened in the original? I mean, I know most, like, movies are supposed to be able to stand on their own, but do you think there's any...
The problem is the original is too clear. Like, I know exactly why all this stupid crap is happening. It's silly. It's just really silly and played really silly. And then the end beat sets up for a sequel that I don't want to see.
Okay.
It's just like, oh, obviously. And then I don't know why anyone would want to watch that movie on purpose, but hey,
okay,
good for them.
All right. Man, I want to get you back on like a year from now when you've caught up with Insidious 2 on Netflix.
I know. Maybe I'm in a bad mood. Maybe I'm just exhausted from Sundance and I'm just being a turd. But it did nothing for me. I was really surprised. And I really like the actors in it. Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne and Barbara Hershey, who was in Black Swan, she's in it, and there's no tone to it. You know, it's really serious in the beginning, and then these paranormal investigators show up, and it's ridiculous. And actually, if there's one haunted house movie to see this week, I'm sorry, I'm taking a really long time, but The Innkeepers is out, and I saw that movie last year at South by Southwest, and that is a really good haunted house movie. I forgot about that.
Cool. Yeah, that's the one by, is it Ty West?
Yeah, that's Ty West, and Sarah Paxton is in it with Pat Healy, and it's a very well-executed extension of quote-unquote mumblecore as a haunted house movie. It's really good.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, check out The Innkeepers then. Tyler, let's go to you. What have you been consuming this past week?
I prefer my haunted house movies to have Eddie Murphy in them. Is that a I prefer a finer taste.
That's haunted mansion movies. That's not the same genre.
I prefer
genre.
A finer taste of cinema. just kidding. Actually, Ben, let me just tell you this right now. Hook is on instant watch now. I checked 2 days ago and it wasn't. And now it is.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. They heard us mumbling about it, so they put it on there right away and I got to miss out on it.
There you go.
A couple things I've been watching. There's this British show that's on instant watch called Black Books. There's like three part. I don't know. I would call them seasons, but there's only six episodes in each season, so I would say like three times it was on television, maybe.
Right. I believe the Brits call that a series. They have three series.
Three series.
Yeah.
and I don't know, it's kind of funny. It reminds me a lot of John Cusack and his character in High Fidelity. It was almost like they took the High Fidelity idea and characters almost and put them in England in a bookshop instead of a music store.
Okay.
Because the main character looks just like John Cusack in High Fidelity, and he acts along the same lines. He's a little crazier, and he's got, like, you know, a Jack Black-esque worker. Yeah, and then there's, like, the lady that works next door, and the three of them drink heavily and get into, you know, all types of situations that rarely have to do with books. It just happens to be surrounded by bookshelves. So
it's a comedy?
Yeah, it's pretty funny, though. I mean, I don't want to suggest it, but, I mean, if you're just dying to watch something during your lunch break like I do, I don't know, check it out.
It's pretty funny, but you don't want to suggest it?
Well, I don't want to suggest it because I think it's funny, but I think a lot of things are funny.
Okay. Cautiously. You're cautiously suggesting it.
Okay.
Well, sure, yeah. And another British show I've been watching on cable, BBC, for some reason. Every once in a while, I'll change my power on station to a different channel that I hardly ever watch.
Wait, you can do that on your TV?
What is a power on station?
You pick like a home page for your TV?
Yeah, like when I power on my cable box, I can set which channel it turns on to.
Oh, right, okay.
So I will switch it to different channels every once in a while. So whenever I turn on the TV, like for 5 seconds or whatever, I'll have to watch this channel. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I do it just to see what other channels look like, because there's like 900,000 channels I have, and I want to experience all of them because that's what I pay for.
Right.
So like one time money. It was, yeah, one time it was like the MLB Network, and then the next time it was I don't know, a bunch of other channels. Well, this time around, this series, I put it at BBC, and they have this show called Top Gear. Have you ever seen this before?
It's the car show, right?
Yeah, it's like a gearhead show, but it's a little more than that. Like they definitely talk about cars, but it's not like Speed Channel intense, where you have no idea what they're talking about. They just like talking about fast cars and real nice cars and things like that. And so it's more of like, ooh, that car looks nice, instead of, I don't know what a muffler is. But a lot of the show's like an hour long, so they have like multiple parts. So one time they'll interview a guest and then have them race the guest will race their car around their track. So they're constantly like racing cars around this same track.
Mm-hmm.
They have like this long list of all the different cars and what times they came in at. And then they have a list of their guests' cars and where they came in at. So, like, you'll get, like, a Eurovan or something. And somebody's like, that's what I drive around in. And I go, oh, why don't you just take a roll around our track? And so they'll time how long it takes.
So are these, like, celebrity guests? Are they, like, Julia Roberts finished in 14 seconds?
they're like British celebrities, I guess.
Okay.
People in England know who they are. I don't. But it's hosted by these three guys, and they're really funny, and there's like a good dynamic between all three of them, because one of them's kind of like, I don't know, each one's different, which is kind of funny. And a lot of times they'll have races. They'll have these real big epic races, and they're like, okay, we got to go from the south of England to like Northumberland or whatever the north of England's called. And like each one, they like draw straws to see which of the three vehicles they're going to get. And sometimes like you get shafted. And you get like the shitty car or whatever.
Yep.
And the most epic one I watched recently was somebody sent him in a letter that said, what would your show be like if it was set in the 1940s? And they were like, okay, well, let's do that. Let's have a race as if it was the 1940s. And so they got the fastest motorcycle at the time, the fastest car at the time, and then like one guy got the steam engine train. And they raced like across the country.
How do they lay track for this train? I don't understand.
No, they set it up so that he could ride on the train like in the engine room. He was like shoveling coal the whole time. So this other guy was like riding up in his car, and he's like, "Yeah, this is pretty awesome." And this other guy's like, "Oh, I'm gonna get there so fast," but he ends up like shoveling coal the whole time, and there's delays with the train and all this kind of stuff. So it was a pretty epic, and you know they make it epic. Music and stuff, and it's all shot in high def, so it looks really nice, and the cars look nice. So
yeah,
I'm not a car guy at all. Like I have no idea how cars work or anything.
Yeah,
it's like a real Cannonball Run or something crazy.
Yeah,
sounds like a cartoon.
Yeah, that Penelope pit stops rip roaring. But you know what I'm talking about, where they have like Dudley Do Right and all those
people
racing absurd cars.
Oh, what was that show called? The Hanna-Barbera. Yeah, all the characters were there racing. That was amazing.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And then I went and saw The Descendants, that George Clooney movie.
Okay, I still haven't seen that. What did you think about it, Tyler?
There was some dark humor, but kind of depressing, but nothing to keep you from going out and seeing it. I mean, Clooney's good in it. He directed it, I guess.
I think Alexander Payne.
Alexander Payne directed. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't research this stuff. I just make assumptions and hope people go along with it. Clooney's in it. They said Rob Hubel was in it. He's a pretty funny comedian, but he's only in it for like a little bit. Like, don't think that it's a Clooney. It's not a Cuny Hubel vehicle or anything,
right?
And like the funnier people are like his teenage daughter and her friend. Like, she's just like really not obnoxious, just really out of control. And they kind of calm her down throughout the movie. And they're dealing with this accident that his wife is in, and they're like going. It's set in Hawaii, so they're constantly like going around in like Hawaiian, environments, and hilarity and sorrow ensues.
Okay,
yeah. So I would go check that out. I would go see that in theaters before it's. I don't think it gets a lot of press. I don't know why.
Well, it won the Golden Globe for Best Picture. Patches, have you seen The Descendants?
I have. And I'm a big fan of it. I'm a pretty big fan of Alexander Payne's past movies like Sideways and About Schmidt and Election. Mm-hmm. For me, this wasn't one of his best. You know, I'm still like a Sideways Election guy. Mm-hmm. I have trouble like being emotionally invested in George Clooney and anything. For
is
some
he
reason,
just too big.
Yeah, which I guess is a weird thing to get hung up on, but I think it's possible. I think he can kind of go over the cliff with fame, and it's like he's just doing George Clooney and riffing. Although, you know, I've seen him in stuff that people can utilize George Clooney in that respect. Like The American. Did you see The American last year?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
Which is about like George Clooney's face. That's what the movie's about. and making it, you know, he's a chiseled guy and they embrace it. Here it's like he's trying to play a regular Joe, and I just have some difficulty getting into it. But I think the writing is really sharp, and like you were saying, the supporting performances, this girl in the movie who plays his daughter, both of the daughters, there's two girls, one's really young and she's a great actress too. Like the surprising young people performances in this movie that really carry it. So I'd highly recommend it. I think it's made like $100 million or something. It's done really, really well.
Nice.
And a big surprise.
I think it's also got a nomination for Best Picture of the Oscars coming up.
Yep.
So.
And Beau Bridges was pretty good in it too.
Yeah, Beau Bridges rules. And so was Matthew Lillard.
Beau Bridges, the dad from The Wizard.
There you go. Call back to a previous episode.
Not Jeff Bridges. Is that Beau Bridges? No, that's Jeff.
And I think The Descendants was also co-written by Jim Rash, who plays the dean on Community on NBC. So
true.
Fans of that show may be looking for some more of his work.
That show's not coming back, dude.
We're not going to get into that, Tyler.
Back. You're going to have to get in on, like, burn DVDs to get the old episodes.
Get my fix somehow. All right. Well, for me, I haven't had a ton of time to catch up on movies, but I did get a chance to see one a couple nights ago. The Los Angeles County Museum of Art was hosting a conversation with Gary Oldman, kind of sponsored by Film Independent, which is a really great program. If you're in LA, check out filmindependent.org. They've got a ton of cool stuff going on. Actually, coming up tomorrow night, they're doing another kind of conversation thing with Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill, and Billy Bean, the guy that Brad Pitt played in Moneyball.
Billy
and
Bean.
then they're doing a screening of Moneyball after that. And all this stuff is like open to the public. So it's like $10 for tickets or something like that, if you can actually get into it. So they've got a really cool program set up over there. And they did this conversation with Gary Oldman. They played one of his movies called State of Grace, which I've never heard of before. starred Sean Penn, Oldman, obviously, Ed Harris, Robin Wright, John Turturro, John C. Reilly, a bunch of really great people. And then they did this conversation, and then they played a movie called The Contender, which I didn't stick around for. It was way too late at that point. I hadn't eaten dinner yet, so I just bailed. But The Contender sounded really good, too. It's got Joan Allen, Jeff Bridges, not Bo, and Oldman and a couple other people. It's like a political thriller. It came out in the year 2000. But I'll talk a little bit about State of Grace, because I did see that one, and it came out in 1990. It was directed by a guy named Phil Janot, who I've never heard of before. But this movie it came out in 1990, and it kind of has that 90s feel to it, if you know what I mean. It's set in New York and Hell's Kitchen, and it's very kind of, I hate to say gritty, but that's what it is. Like, most of the movie is shot from kind of the ground level, almost. You never really get these big sweeping shots of New York and kind of, you know, from the camera being really high up looking down on people. It's always like the other way around, where they're almost glorifying these kind of mobster, like small time hoods, basically, is what these guys are. So Sean Penn plays this guy named Terry Noonan, who has been gone from New York for 10 years, comes back and gets back into the life of this kind of Irish gang that he's got going on, with Gary Oldman, who plays this really insane, really bombastic character named Jackie Flannery, who's kind of like the wild card. His hair is really long, and he's always speaking just breathlessly, like he doesn't have enough air to convey all the stuff that he wants to say at all times. Like, he's just very, like, fly by the seat of his pants. And Ed Harris is the guy who's now in charge of this Irish mob. He's Gary Oldman's brother in the movie. And there's this this very serious kind of gangland battle going on between the Irish and the Italians. And if you like movies like that, then this one is definitely one to check out. It's kind of conventional, but the performances, like, as far as the story goes, but the performances really bring it to another level, I think. And Robin Wright is really great in it. And there's a big twist that comes halfway through, and I'm not going to say what it is, but I'd say it's worth watching, especially because it's got such a great cast, and it was from, you know, it's one of Oldman's best performances that I've ever seen. So if, you know, watch it for nothing else than just Gary Oldman's performance. So it's called State of Grace, and I don't know if it's available on Netflix instant, because I haven't researched that, so sorry. But yeah, check it out if it's on TV or something like that, and you stumble across it, and you're like, hey, I remember somebody talking about this. It's worth seeing. The conversation itself was pretty cool. There was a lot of actors and stuff in the crowd, too. Paul Dano was there. Like, you know, it's like, it's Gary freaking Oldman. Even his contemporaries want to hear what he has to say about the craft of acting. And
Paul Dano loves Gary Oldman.
That's a well-known fact, obviously. So there's
Dano.
You know, he talked a lot about his influences in the early days and kind of what got him into acting. And I'm going to write up this piece for geektyrant.com. It's going to be going up tomorrow morning, about kind of like five quotes. Like, they wouldn't let you let anybody record anything in there, but I managed to, like, scribble down furiously five quotes that I thought were really interesting from him. So you can check that out at geektyrant.com tomorrow morning. So that'll be Monday. Probably by the time you listen to this episode, it'll be up there.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. Ben, you're doing the weekly video roundup nowadays.
Well, the daily, yeah. We've started a daily video blog there, where basically I just run down, like, the top five news stories of the day. It's pretty simple. It's, you know, we're just trying to get video off the ground over there, and everything will get a lot more technologically impressive as we get a little bit more money and kind of, you know, expand our scope a little bit. But yeah, I'm just trying to build a little bit of a video program over there right now.
Have you seen the YouTube comment on your second episode?
I haven't. Somebody was telling. I don't really. But YouTube, first of all, is
like, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you what it said.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, go ahead. Just, yeah, let's hear it.
Horrible to look and listen to.
Wow. All right.
And it doesn't help that the top part of your head is cut off in every episode because the camera is too close to your face.
All right. Great.
Yep. Just saying. And I didn't write it. I didn't write it.
I think you did write it, Tyler.
I did enjoy reading it, but I didn't write it. The same thing is done on your Skype picture, too.
Amazing.
It's like you love that, like, fractional area of any picture or video screen.
Okay.
I'm just saying, dude.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for crushing.
You should keep doing it because it's a trademark. It's a trademark thing.
All right. Well, yeah. In any case, people can check out that kind of stuff at Geek Tyrant if they want to. But let's go ahead and move on into our review of Hook.
Maggie! The stories are true. He's come back to seek his revenge. Only you can save your children. You must make yourself remember.
Remember what?
Peter, don't you know who you are?
Have to fly. Have to fight. Have to crow. Have to save Maggie. Have to save Jack. Okay, he's back. Who?
All right, so Hook came out in 1991. It was directed by Steven Spielberg, stars Robin Williams, Dustin Hoffman, Julia Roberts, Bob Hoskins, a bunch of other people. Before we kind of go around and do our like introductory thoughts on Hook itself, Patches, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this concept of the Spielberg face.
Sure.
Would you care to explain to people that whole, like the rundown of basically how that came to be and kind of what it is?
Sure. Well, I was in earlier this year, last year, maybe February or so, I did an article while freelancing at UGO.com called The Spielberg Face, A Legacy. which was basically an excuse to screen cap all of Spielberg's movies. And, I saw this trend and I'm sure other people did, too. But it didn't seem like anyone had really just pointed it out in a photographic way, mm-hmm. which is, people making this face, this reaction face to something that's all inspiring or striking fear in them. But he always does it in kind of the same way. It's this mouth agape looking wide-eyed, and he pushes the camera in, and it has an emotional reaction. I think people connect that moment to Spielberg's movies, and that's kind of what his movies embody, this. If it's Jurassic Park with seeing the dinosaurs for the first time, or if it's Close Encounters with seeing the spaceship rise up, or if it's like Sugarland Express, his first little movie where Goldie Hawn is looking at what's his name getting shot or something. It's just like all these different moments, and he's very much about cinematic awe. And the article chronicled that, went through all his movies and found those moments and, declared this the Spielberg face. This is what he does. And I'm sure other people have used it in the past, but it's such a trend, a link between all his films that it was fun to point out. Mm-hmm. And then later this year, someone who follows me on Twitter who works for a website called Fandor, a really interesting indie film, foreign film website that you should definitely check out, Fandor.com. Because they end up distributing and streaming a lot of stuff too.
Okay.
But this guy was looking for suggestions, or he was pondering. He wanted to do a video essay on Spielberg. And I told him, I'm like, look at this article, because here's something that I should have done in video in the first place, mm-hmm. really. And he's like, oh my God, this obviously struck a chord with him. And if you Google the Spielberg face now, you'll probably A, find my article, and B, find this amazing video essay he did, kind of exploring what that idea means and how Spielberg has used it effectively and how it's changed. He has this really interesting point about, these early movies, Empire of the Sun, Jurassic Park, Close Encounters, all are about, look at the things that are happening that are incredible and awe-inspiring. And then like 9/11 happens, and then suddenly Spielberg's making all these dark movies where like War of the Worlds and Munich, where all the Spielberg faces are like, holy shit, we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrifying. And he made some really interesting links. And it was the reactions to it have been kind of like, why is this a thing? Why would anyone point this out? People do this all the time. But it certainly is a link between all of his films. And in the movie we're about to talk about, Hook obviously is something about like discovery. I think his movies rely heavily on discovery and the majesty of that moment. And especially I think his connection to young people, you see a lot of the young people kind of having this moment where they're maturing through the Spielberg face, mm-hmm. in some capacity. And that's what happens to Peter in Hook, where he rediscovers and he probably had the Spielberg face when he was a kid, but then he left Neverland and came back, and suddenly he's having the Spielberg face all over again.
Yeah.
So So it was really interesting. The video he did was amazing. It's amazingly put together. I think it runs like 9 minutes or something, but it's a very fascinating exploration of that shot, of that moment that Spielberg has kind of injected into all of his films.
Yeah. Cool, man. Yeah, that's really awesome. So I'll have to go back and read your original article because I've seen that video but haven't read the...
It's probably not as insightful as the video essay because I love making jokes about things.
So. Right. Okay. Well,
I had a joke.
What's that, Tyler?
I had a joke.
Oh, go ahead.
A joke question.
I love joke questions.
I'm actually not going to do it because it's in bad taste, but it involved the idea of the O face. So,
it's kind of similar to the O face.
Okay.
I think the Spielberg
is
face
there a connection
is
between
a,
Spielberg's face or the Spielberg face and Spielberg's O face.
He probably makes the Spielberg face.
Yeah.
But the Spielberg face tends to not it doesn't involve as much cleanup.
Oh gosh.
Okay. So there you go. I went with that joke.
Wow. All right, well, let's clean this show up a little bit and talk a little bit about Hook. Let's do some kind of introductory thoughts. Tyler, let's start with you. What do you think about Hook?
Man, 91. We're freaking old because I remember this movie coming out. It was around the same time as Dick Tracy, featuring the same kid. Yeah. Saw it like a number of times as a child on, what's it called, VHS?
Yes.
Than we used to have. And yeah, I like the Disney version, which I believe in my Wikipedia reading of Hook in days past, weeks past, years past, not including the blackout day, it was supposed to be a sequel to the cartoon version. And if you do watch it, it does have a lot of, not a lot, but a few hints of kind of that the Disney cartoon version kind of being the predecessor to Hook, and you know, kind of what they were trying to do back in the 80s, and that's kind of a cool aspect of it. But yeah, a lot of people think it's corny, but I think it, and everyone talks about nostalgia and stuff like that. So maybe that's why I like it so much. I don't know. I can't explain my actions. Yeah, it's really good. It's one of my, I think, Ben, do you remember back in, I don't know, when Geek Tyrant did like the best of, maybe it was like the best of something podcast, and you guys did like your top five movies and top five TV shows?
Yep.
I think Hook made it into my top five.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. Yeah, for me, I really enjoy this movie. Like Tyler, I grew up watching it, so it's hard for me to separate myself from, you know, those memories of being a kid and seeing that TriStar logo for the first time and kind of just like the swelling feelings that brings back.
You don't have to separate yourself from that.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I think I've watching it this time, because this is the first time I've seen it in years, like probably a good 10 years or something. But I remembered things, you know, line for line, like word for word. It was really kind of an amazing experience because I love this movie so much. And yeah, I think, Patches, I came to that conclusion as this movie was coming to a close. It was like, you know what? I don't think I need to separate myself from, like, it's okay. You know, you don't have to watch every movie with a completely 100% critical eye. There are times in your life when movies mean something to you and you're not going to be able to separate yourself from that. And I think for me, Hook is one of those, because I know the movie's kind of widely derided. Is this that the right word? Derided in the critical community?
Derided?
I think pooped on. Is the word.
Sure. So, you know.
Those people are douchebags, Ben.
Wow.
Let's just get that out there right now.
Talk about broad generalization.
Douchebags.
But I think.
They don't understand.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's. Watching it now, it's like, okay, it's a lot more obvious to me as an adult watching this movie that the entire thing was shot on sound stages and that some of the stuff is a little kitschy and a little, you know, kind of ridiculous. But I think the great kind of memories of me being a kid watching this movie kind of overwhelms all that. So I don't know. It's hard for me to kind of really fully separate myself, but I don't think I want to. Patches, what do you think?
I mean, I tend to agree with you that there's a lot of people who kind of brush it off. And I think it's because we hold Spielberg in high regard and he's made some truly fantastic films that work on every level. And Hook is a movie. I always stray away from calling something a kid's movie and giving it like it can get off because it's a kid's movie. It doesn't have to be good. Well, I disagree. I mean, movies for kids should be good. And I think Hook is, but it's geared towards children. It's geared towards people who want to think about their childhood too, obviously. So saying that it's like movie rooted in nostalgia that clouds your vision. No, it's a movie about nostalgia. It's a movie about not, you know, you don't have to be nostalgic to think about your childhood and think about why that's important.
Mm-hmm.
I like the film. I think it's a movie about design. It's a movie about spectacle. You know, I know that it was originally going to be too a John Williams, the composer, was trying to do an opera about Peter Pan. So a lot of the music comes from that too, which I think is really interesting because they were just able to kind of put the cinematic visuals with that music.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that was conceived first too, and I don't think it's obviously his best movie in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think people want to cut it apart on a critical level as if talking about movies as a science. You know, it's like it's not a good movie. Your vision is clouded. No, it hits the heart, and it's a very heartfelt film, and I think that Robin Williams is very good in it. You know, he does some of his zany stuff when he's becoming Peter Pan, but there's also some very tender moments. There's some parts where one of the boys like goes up to his face and starts touching his face and trying to remember who Peter Pan was.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, here you are, Peter. Here you are. And that's a very touching moment.
Yeah.
But it's all from a child's perspective. It's one of Spielberg's only films that has, like, it's really about children. You know, E.T. had a child's perspective on the real world, but here's a child's perspective on a child's world and a fantasy world rooted in their mind. Mm. And I think it's very interesting in that respect. And Robin Williams was a very good fit for that. A lot better than Michael Jackson originally planned.
Wow.
Not have gone well, I don't think.
Yeah, especially with his kind of extracurricular relationship with kids.
Alleged.
Difficult.
Alleged.
Right. Alleged, thank you, yeah. Forgive me.
It went through a court of law.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of really touching moments in this movie that have to do with growing up and being a kid and that whole, like, the kind of constant battle between those things. And I think, yeah, like Robin Williams does have this kind of childlike enthusiasm more than a lot of actors. And it is because of his kind of zany personality and a lot of the crazy stuff that he does. But he's able to hit something here that kind of strikes that balance, you know, like right when he kind of becomes Peter Pan again after that great scene where he learns to fly again for the first time. He goes to Tinkerbell and he's like talking about like what kind of games are going to play and all this stuff. And she is the one who has to kind of bring him back to Earth. And in that brief moment where he kind of forgets that the entire reason he's at Neverland is to rescue his kids, you can see like very easily this whole thing could have been a movie about Robin Williams as Peter Pan, just going on random adventures without any of the kind
of... I think that's what people who don't like it expect. You know, I took to Twitter because I really wanted to get some serious opinions on why people don't like it, because I feel like I hear a lot of people
mm-hmm.
pooping on it. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's a great idea, so poorly executed. Or, you know, and I'm just like, what did you want? I think they wanted, you know, like Lord of the Rings Peter Pan edition, because it's a big screen version of this story. But really, it feels like, you know, considering, Tyler, what you were saying, that it was in the wake of the Disney version that we all treasure so much, too. It almost feels like a comment on that film. You know, like it's OK to like the movies you liked as a kid. It's OK to like those things. You've grown up, but you can come back and embrace them in a new way,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just like, oh, I want to see an adventure in the Peter Pan world. You know, this is what real movies are.
Yeah.
And I think the movie, interestingly, is a comment on how we look back at our own childhoods. And it's not just rooted in nostalgia. It's rooted in emotion and what we found powerful then and how we grew up and if we still feel that it's powerful.
Yeah, and I think there's
the battle
a lot
of...
Oh, go ahead.
The Battle of Hooks Deep, where it's just an epic CGI
Now,
war.
To be fair, I would watch that movie.
Pirates v. Lost Boys.
Yeah, I would see that.
I mean, that big war scene at the end was one of the coolest things I could remember as a kid. Yeah. It's just like, you know, it's like child wish fulfillment in the best possible way. It's like there's no consequences. Right. You know, these huge burly 40 to 50 year old men are wandering around with beards and swords, but you can just shoot them in the face with paint and everything's going to be okay, with the one exception of Rufio's death. And that is one thing that always kind of raise the stakes a little bit, but I don't know, what do you guys think about the way that whole thing played out? Do you think that, because for me it's like in this movie it's that seems like the one really serious thing that's kind
someone
of
always like, someone always dies when you're playing around as a kid, don't you think? I take those scenes, you know, again, when people were responding to my questions about why people don't like the movie, it's like, oh, here's an end scene that has no thrills and they're like not very good at sword fighting, and it's like, this isn't supposed to be Pirates of the Caribbean,
yeah,
you know, big scale action. That scene to me, and speaking to also what you said about the design, that it feels like it's on a set or something, mm-hmm. it feels like I built the fort, or like here's what my imagination would be, and like, yeah. I'm standing on a hill with a bunch of my friends pretending to have sword fight.
Yeah.
And like in that scene, oh, my friend dies. Ah, kill all the bad guys. You know, yeah. So for me, Rufio's death is just kind of an extension of playtime. And then the whole thing is that, you know, you don't have to be a good sword fighter. You just have to pretend to be and be the good guy and you'll win.
Yeah.
Like everything is an extension of what we did with our imaginations as a kid and never losing that.
Yeah. And I think that's done very purposefully in the design too, with like, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but in the background of a lot of the sets, it's just blazing white. There's no skylines or anything like that. It's just like the world stops right there. You know, their imagination creates only the realm that they need to be operating in at that given second. So yeah, I think that kind of speaks to that a little bit. Tyler, do you have any thoughts on Rufio's death or maybe the relationship between Rufio and Peter at any point?
No, I kind of agree with Patches. I mean, I was thinking of it more of as like a wake-up call to Peter again that, you know, this place is not only a fantasy world but also kind of real. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of wakes up a little bit and realizes, okay, this is super serious now. Like, I'm about to, you know, gouge this guy in the face with my sword to get my kids back, because now he's killed another one of my friends. So I always thought of it as like a wake-up call, but Patch is talking about, you know, just kind of an extension of having fun, even though, really, Rufio is dead.
Yeah.
in that world. It's not like he's coming back.
Yeah, the movie's not interested in exploring, like, the grieving process or anything like that, so...
Yeah, I've always considered it a wake-up call, because up until that point, like, everyone was kind of having fun. I mean, it was sort of serious, but everyone was kind of having fun fighting these pirates.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until Rufio died where everyone was like, oh, shit. Like, yeah. These are bad guys. Like, this isn't... Like, we need to be a lot more careful in our war.
Yeah.
Or other Lost Boys are going to die, like Cubs.
So... One of the things that one of the things that I noticed a lot more this time around is, like, when I was a kid, I couldn't wait for, like, the first 45 minutes to be over until they got to Neverland. But, you know, watching it with a little bit more of an adult perspective, you see that the whole buildup of Peter being this kind of corporate shark and not spending time with his kids and all of that kind of stuff, to me, just feels like a direct like copy of what Spielberg must have been going through at the time. It seemed like a projection, kind of like, okay, Spielberg working through these issues of not being there enough for his kids and you know, the kind of plight of the businessman, you know, always separated and on the phone and missing his kids growing up and all of that stuff. I don't know. Did you guys have anything to discuss there? Did any of that connect with you guys or did it just seem kind of forced and unnecessary?
Well, I mean, I like that stuff.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, Tyler, I'm sorry. I cut you off.
Go Patches.
I mean, I like that stuff, and anyone who complains about the movie, you know, being lazy or for kids or doesn't hold up, It's like, that's the dramatic stuff that kind of gets us into it in the first place. And again, here's like Robin Williams doing some really interesting stuff that he's not playing Mork or something. Yeah. He's not being a Looney Tune. And also Phil Collins is in that part. So I really like it. Phil Collins.
In what part? What is
Phil Collins plays the inspector that comes over.
Phil Collins, the musician?
Phil Collins, the drummer, singer.
Wow. Genesis. Did not really? Notice.
Is that him?
That's Phil Collins, yeah. So obviously that part is made even better by Phil Collins.
I actually liked that part a lot because, when it implies that Hook comes in and, or I guess it doesn't imply it. Tells you.
How does he hang up the, note with like a dagger or a,
yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah, there's like a.
That's
yeah.
great. Like when the fantasy world starts to bleed over, like those are wonderful moments. And Tink comes for the first time, I saw a lot of people complaining about how Tinkerbell, Julia Roberts was his. Miscast as Tinkerbell. I don't feel like she's in the movie that much to be miscast as Tinkerbell, but
yeah, I think maybe
she giggles and acts like a fairy.
Yeah, maybe what people were thinking is like that was kind of the perceived height of Julia Roberts' popularity, and it is such a small role. Maybe people think, I don't know, I'm just projecting here, but maybe people think like, oh, this was below her or something. But to have the opportunity to work with Spielberg and Robin Williams in a movie that's going to be very clearly for kids, as you said earlier, it's kind of a timeless movie in that regard. I don't see any problem with Julia Roberts' performance or her being in this movie anyway. So,
I always liked the idea of Captain Hook. I wanted to see that scene where he went and dragged his hook through the wall.
Right.
Like that always amazed me that somebody would come into a house and do so much damage.
Yeah.
And then steal their children. And I was like, okay, wait. So if he came up through the front door, then how did he get back? Like, I always assumed the ship was hanging out somewhere.
Yeah.
I never understood how Hook got there.
Yeah.
And even if he did come on a flying ship, he took the time to go to the front door, break in. He could have just went through the bedroom window.
The window, yeah.
He broke in, dragged up through, haunting the children, probably calling out to them as he approached the bedroom. And it's just a horrific scene that we never get to see.
It's funny that you mentioned that.
Hello
because
there,
that's...
children. I'm coming for you.
That's a testament to good filmmaking, because you can get away doing stuff that doesn't entirely make sense when you really dwell on it, but if it plays to the magic of your film, then peppering it with those images works entirely.
Yeah.
Like we love that we see that Hook's been stomping around their house. It doesn't make any sense, but it's so good.
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and then
he wants to destroy that childhood home of the people that messed him up back in thousands of years ago. I don't know how long Peter Pan's been there.
Right. And then, there's also that thing where, talking about the bleed over between the two worlds, you've got, when Tinkerbell first, wraps him up in swaddling clothes and takes him to Neverland, she is, leaking fairy dust on that kissing couple on the bridge, and they just start flying because they're, making out and thinking happy thoughts. And then later in the very end of the movie, when Toodles gets his marbles back, there's a pocket of fairy dust that's just been kept in there, and he pours it all over himself and starts flying around. And the movie ends with everybody oh, Toodles, and he's just sailing around out above London. There's no consequences for that. There's nobody calls the cops. Nobody's what the hell is going on? There are people flying, but this movie doesn't.
Yeah. Hook 2, interest. The Search for Toodles. Yeah. I would have seen that movie.
The movie has no interest in exploring stuff like that, and I think rightly so. It keeps it to the kind of important things and just lets people like us who like to laugh about the implications of them, it lets us do our thing.
The couple that was kissing soon realized after they were done that they were 60 miles away, in Scotland, just floating around in the sky.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Patches, you talked about a tender moment, and I think the one tender moment that I always get kind of, emotional about is when he's remembering everything, and he realizes why he leaves Neverland in the first place. And watching it as an adult, if I'd watched it for this episode, I've watched it within the last year, I'm sure.
Okay.
And that's kind of the moment where I realized that it's kind of an adult movie too, and people that may have watched it 20 years ago and watch it today they've now kind of switched roles. They've switched spots.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're a kid back in the 90s, you're associating with the Lost Boys and the fun that they're having. Well, now as an adult, I'm starting to realize, you know,
right,
why Peter Pan decided to grow up in the first place was to have a kid and be a dad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just kind of something that I always get kind of struck by, even though I know it's happening. It's kind of something that as you get older, you're kind of like, well, you know, this movie is about kind of realizing why you grow up or why you need to grow up or so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I'm really scared to eventually watch this movie with my children.
I need to sign off and start weeping. So if you guys excuse me,
you know, I think Tyler, you hit on a good point there. Something that Spielberg does in a lot of his movies, and I think probably most recently in War Horse, is that he is able to manipulate the audience in such an effective way that even though you're aware you're being manipulated, it still works.
I don't like the word manipulated. I don't think he manipulates his audience.
Well,
I think he
Touch,
does.
I think every movie is manipulation, don't you? I mean, it's all about...
No, I think manipulation is, to go back to the beginning of this podcast, I think manipulation is like a jump scare when I throw a music cue at you and I make you, like, shiver in your seat.
Okay.
I think what Spielberg does is serve you a well-orchestrated moment of emotion, and he plays to the universality of that feeling, and that's why you get, like, you get choked up or you get a tingle in your spine, you
okay.
know? I think there's a difference there, not to get too heady about it, but I think
manipulation
is nefarious, whereas as being a cinematic master is much different.
Yeah, well, I mean, go ahead, Tyler, were you going to say something?
I was going to try to explain how I felt about the word manipulation, but then Pat just said nefarious, and my explanation could have been summed up in the word nefarious.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you just said. I just think I think Spielberg does it well. That's the entire point I'm trying to make, is that he does craft these scenes and kind of serve this thing to you. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's a very clear thing that he's trying to do, and any time that you try to elicit an emotional response from somebody, I think there has to be some sort of manipulation. I just don't think manipulation necessarily always has to have the negative connotation to it. I think, yeah, it's probably more often than not used in a negative way, but I wasn't trying to use it in a negative way. I think, you know, I agree with what you're saying. We're all kind of right there on the same page.
We are all right.
I manipulate someone to adopt a puppy.
He's done a good job.
That's a positive spin.
So let's see.
John Williams's best work, perhaps.
I mean, I don't know about best. For me, it's like,
oh man,
a lot of the stuff, like the flying theme, which you people who are listening to this episode heard in the very beginning of the music to open this show, is one of Williams' best pieces, I think. But I don't know if the score overall is representative of his best work. Tyler, do you think it is?
It's up there. It's in the top, let's see, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Hook? Yeah, it's top three.
Top three, wow, okay. Well, Patches, what do you think about the score?
I think the score services the movie really well. I don't know if it's probably not in the top five John Williams scores for me. I'm a movie musicaholic, so. But oddly enough, when I was looking for responses to Hook from people on Twitter, someone told me it's the most typical Spielberg score ever, blah.
Wow.
So I was very surprised by that. I think it has a lot more going on than a lot of John Williams's other scores, mostly because it started as an opera, like I was talking about earlier, and I think it's more complicated than that and less obviously thematic like some of his other ones. It's not Star Wars, you know. It's not Indiana Jones. It's more complicated than that, which is why if you pick up the soundtrack or something, that main theme is like a 9-minute piece of music.
Yeah.
It's just more interesting. So it doesn't stand out as one of the best scores, but it probably is the most intricate.
Yeah, the thing I love about Williams' music is that listening to it, when I think it's really good is when I can listen to it and imagine every single scene as the music goes on. Like I have... I have Hook on, and I have Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and I can listen to both of those and know, like, just by the tones and the music, like, what's happening in the movie.
Yeah.
And so that's why I throw it up so high, because it's one of those Williams scores that I can say, it's like reading a book almost. Like, when you read the novelization of the movie, it's telling you in words what's going on. Well, you can listen to John Williams and be like, well, instead of reading, you're listening to what's actually happening in the movie without actually watching it.
Yeah.
Whatever. I'm a nerd.
So what do you guys think? I mean, Spielberg is widely known for exploring these themes of fatherhood in his movies, and there's a lot going on in Hook as far as father-son relationships. You know, you've got Peter and Jack, you've got Jack and Hook, you've got Peter and Rufio, you've got all these different things. What did you guys think about the effectiveness of exploring those relationships? Anyone? No?
I was going to let Tyler go first.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's how I was waiting for the same thing. Not for me to go, for you to go. I'll go first this time. I love the dynamic between Jack and Hook, because Hook, if you're looking for a negative connotation to manipulation, Hook is doing exactly that, where he's trying to basically get back at Peter Pan by winning over his son, which mm-hmm. is diabolical. So he, like, the whole baseball scene where Hook, he goes, "Your father never went to your baseball games, did he, Jack?" "I'll go to all your baseball games, Jack."
Yeah.
And so he, like, he does this whole thing, and no one, even though I guess the game's not that old, but let's say 1500, 1600 pirates have no idea how baseball's played. And just the idea of all these pirates, like, just working together and them kind of having fun like the Lost Boys would have fun.
Yeah.
But in a manipulative, negative connotation way of trying to win over Jack and trying to get Jack to forget about his dad, to forget about the real world, and to kind of focus on being a pirate. That's always been one of my favorite scenes, because, you know, me and my dad, we like baseball too. He went to all my games. Not to say that there was any, you know, stuff.
He'll
like
go
that
to all
going
your
on.
Games, Tyler. Your dad will go to all your games.
But the scene, isn't it the scene right before that where he destroys all the clocks?
Yes, I think so.
That's another great scene that I like, because that's like the first sign Hook's trying to get his quote unquote hooks in Jack.
Nice.
his real hook versus the proverbial hooks in
right.
Jack.
Can I go off topic for just a second? I think the only way that the pirates know how to play baseball is because of Smee's reconnaissance missions to the real world, which he learns everything about, you know, because it implies that Smee was at both the play, Maggie's play in the very beginning, and yes. and also at Jack's baseball game, which is kind of...
He had to be.
You know, although, to be fair, you don't know, maybe everyone in Neverland used to live in the real world. So maybe they remember baseball from back when they weren't pirates.
I think that too. I think, but Ben has a point where I think Smee had been there recently.
Yeah. And then also, I mean, I guess just to continue this little rabbit trail, what do you guys think about the like janitor of Bob Hoskins playing that janitor role at the very end where he's like sweeping up beer bottles? It's like, that was the same guy. So like, what do you make of that? Anything? Or is that just like a stupid offhanded, like, oh, this is kind of funny because it looks just like Smee.
I mean, I think that speaks to the fact that it does, like, maybe the Neverland is not real. Maybe it is real. It doesn't matter.
Okay, yeah, because I was wondering the same thing. You know, like, you were talking about the scene where Tinkerbell comes to him at the very first time or whatever, and right before that he's drinking, so it's like you could maybe look at this as, okay, it's all just this drunken stupor, and then he ends up, you know, like, laid out in the gutter afterwards, and, you know, there's a lot of, like, maybe this isn't real, but then I think the movie just kind of, like, defiantly says one way or the other at the very end when Tootles is like flying around in front of everyone. Like, there's no way to hide the fact that, okay, this is actually happening. So, but yeah.
I think Smee came back. He's like, well, I can't work with Captain Hook anymore. I might as well come back.
Okay, yeah, that's
a power job, being a janitor.
Yeah.
That's
and like, when he talks to Peter, I think he's kind of, I don't know, maybe there's like a time-space thing where he came like 15 years before. But he knows who Peter Pan is, or maybe he's forgotten about Neverland too at this point. I don't know, but
yeah.
Peter is almost like I recognize you, but I kind of don't. Like,
yeah.
It's that kind of like Tink says, you know, between sleep and awake, that's
yeah.
what Neverland is really. So like Peter remembers the most of what happened. But
yeah.
it is sort of like a dream where you don't remember everything. So Smee could be like that part of the dream that he just doesn't really recall.
Yeah, man, that's fascinating. I never even thought about that.
Boosh. I've watched this movie 1,000 times. Pat, get back to Patch's thoughts on the
yeah,
father dynamics.
On the dynamics of the father relationships. What'd you make of that, Patches?
Well, I think... You know, the father-son stuff obviously plays to Spielberg's obsessions and his interests, which is why I don't think that the movie is manipulative, as we were talking before, because it's rooted in so many questions, I'm sure, that he's asking himself and exploring through the film. And it also legitimizes it, in my mind, why writing it off as like a kid's movie or something that people only get invested in because of nostalgic reasons is very silly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he does a really good job about saying, you know, here's a guy who's lost his way of being a father. And in something like Close Encounters, that's, you know, this is very possible for a dad with a lot of emotional investment in his family to kind of totally go off the tracks and ignore them and take on his own life and responsibilities and what that means, the ramifications of that. Here's a guy who's able to come back from his own choices and learn
yeah.
to be a father again. And how it's easy to pretend to be a father by being manipulative like Captain Hook. And you don't have to be that way. You just have to be honest and true and discover yourself. You know, it's sometimes a disturbing – something that I believe and something that's disturbing to many people is that you have to figure yourself out and put yourself first before you can help other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this movie kind of speaks to that. It's like put your own mask on when the plane's going down and then put your kid's mask on.
Yeah.
Kind of feeling. So it's like Peter has to discover himself and then go and save his kids.
Yeah.
I think it's a powerful message. I think it's a powerful film.
Yeah. I think
using Peter Pan as its gateway to exploring those themes. But
yeah, I mean, that's like a good point about Close Encounters, too, because it really does feel like an evolution of Spielberg as like his philosophies, you know, what he actually believes. I mean, obviously this movie wasn't written by him, but I think there's a lot of, you know, you'd take the auteur theory into account as like, you know, looking at a director's body of work and seeing themes, you know, over and over again and stuff like that. I think there's something to be said about the way that Close Encounters ends, which I'm not going to spoil in case people haven't seen it, because I actually hadn't seen it until last year for the first time, or 2010 for the first time. But check out Close Encounters, people, if you haven't seen that. And then there's something, you know, interesting about the way that movie ends and then the way that it's kind of resolved a lot differently, we'll say, in Hook and, you know, 20 years later, 20-some-odd years later. Yeah, it just shows kind of an evolution of Spielberg's thought process, I think.
Did all that stuff stem from Spielberg and his kids or Spielberg and his dad?
It must have been.
Well, I think both. I think this movie is speaking to both of those things. You know, I know that I think that his dad and him had a troubled relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But like, as you were mentioning, Ben, that I'm sure that his own occupational pressures inform this movie, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even if you look at E.T., like the father figure is completely absent.
Yeah.
So I always cited that as, you know, that was kind of the, well, Jaws.
The shark is the dad.
Is it? He just wants to blow it to pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah, whenever I talk about the Spielberg father relationship, I always cite E.T. because, you know, that's kind of the first one I put in like the father series, I guess.
Yeah.
That was the first one that was kind of like kids and then something. And, you know, when I was watching them as a kid and I always wondered where the dad was. And now as a grown up, I'm going to be like, oh, that was a intentional choice instead
yeah.
of a dumb kid being like, where's the dad?
Yeah.
Why are they playing? Why are they eating dinner without a dad? That doesn't make sense.
I mean, I think that's a lot of the stuff that I had in my notes that I wanted to talk about. I think we touched on
that. That is Hook. That's
stuff.
The movie Hook.
Last
also,
question.
Guys, Glenn Close is in Hook.
What?
I don't know if
what?
You that. Glenn Close plays a pirate. Pre-Albert Nobbs cross-dressing, she cross-dresses as a pirate.
No way. Are you
serious? I'm springing all these cameos on you. I just remembered that.
That's insane.
Yeah. Look for her in, well, you won't be able to find her unless you like pause right at that moment.
What, do you know what scene it's in?
You know when they're I feel like it's one of the first pirate scenes. They're like all fighting each other, or maybe when does Peter show up?
Yeah.
Shows up once where he has no idea what's going on and they're all giving him a hard time, and then they tell him to get out, right?
That Tinkerbell like dresses him as a pirate and coaches him on how to like walk around and grunt and stuff like that.
It's in that big pirate scene on the boat.
Okay.
That's when Glenn Close, for some reason, is dressed up as a pirate.
And Gwyneth Paltrow playing young Wendy, too.
Yeah.
Has noticed that.
Is cameo heaven.
Yeah.
I think that was her first role, too.
It may have been.
Because she was friends with somebody, either a producer or Spielberg himself. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, her mom was Blythe Danner, so that helps.
Oh, okay. I somehow never knew that. Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
The big question is, was Captain Hook flying the plane over to England?
Yeah, he was. That was his voice.
Was that him?
On the loudspeaker, totally.
All right, so they have been here. I thought he might have, I agreed with you, Ben. I thought he might have sent people over to do stuff for him, but
they've infiltrated.
All accounts show that Hook was leading the expedition.
There's a Neverland terrorist cell somewhere in England.
Better watch out. They'll throw tomatoes at random buildings and all kinds of crazy pirate-esque things.
Right in this movie had to have been sweet. Like, everyone's just kind of like this higher thinking. It's like, no one's going to notice this stuff. Like, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be like 20 years looking back before still figuring stuff out.
Yeah.
And that's what we did.
Yep.
Nice job.
All right. That's pretty much it. So let's do some kind of concluding thoughts before we bring this episode to a close. So, Tyler, any final thoughts on Hook?
If you've never seen this movie, watch it immediately. It'll help you understand your childhood a little more, I think. And if you say anything bad about it, you're a douchebag, and I will come and fight you.
Wow. That's the kind of...
Damn. Land it on the table.
With my last breath, I will defend this movie.
Well, I think we've done a pretty admirable job of that today. Patches, any final thoughts?
I mean, I think that a lot of people do love this movie out of a childhood memory, and that it's obviously worth checking out again and thinking about some of the bigger themes. I would really, really want to read somebody's negative piece on Hook, because I don't understand why people hate on it so much. Mm-hmm. I think it's just, you know, you can't compare it to the rest of Spielberg's work. You really can't compare anything to anyone else's work. I don't think that's fair. And Hook gets a bad rap, but I think it is a genuinely charming, you know, film. So it gets a bad rap. And also Phil Collins' best performance to date.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun,
dun. in the air tonight. He sees Toodles.
I love Phil Collins, man. Last breath, Ben. Last breath.
Yeah, no, I mean, I like this movie a lot, obviously. I think, you know, even talking about it now makes me like it even more than I did, you know, yesterday when I was rewatching it. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on that maybe people don't give the movie credit for, that it deals with a little bit more of the adult themes, more than just the kid stuff. And I think there's a lot to like about the movie. So, let's see. Why don't we go ahead and move in? Or Tyler, actually, why don't you pull the old Apple II and let people know what we're going to be watching next week?
Sure, no problem. Let me pull that lever. Yeah, for next week we'll be watching They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, the sequel to In the Heat of the Night, starring Sidney Poitier. So if you want to really prepare yourself, you don't have to, because we're not going to. You can watch In the Heat of the Night and then watch They Call Me Mr. Tibbs. Not to be confused with Mr. Tubbs, which is Tubbs grown up, I guess, coming back from... Was that his name? Was that his name, Tubbs?
I looked it up, and it's actually Thud. T-H-U-D. I always thought it was Tubbs as well. And then at one point, as a kid, I remember thinking it might have been Thad. But I don't know. It was always really unclear. But I turned on the subtitles specifically to see what that kid's name was. And it's
okay.
It's Thud. Wikipedia names him Thud Butt, actually, as his last name.
Oh, okay. So, I thought they might have called him Tubbs at one point in the film, but I guess not.
Maybe it was just a nickname, you know.
Yeah.
Could be. I don't know.
Well, it's not him. It's not. He's. It's not Mr. Tubbs. It's not. It's Mr. Tibbs. They call me Mr. Tibbs. It's on Instant Watch, so check it out. And we'll see. I have no idea what it's about, and we'll see what it's about next week.
Okay, cool. So you guys can check out that movie. Shoot us an email. Let us know what you think of it. And notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. Give us your thoughts on Hook. If you're a fan, if you're a hater, let us know. Call us at 904-469-6566 and leave us a voicemail. You can check us out on Facebook. We're on Twitter, twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. We have a few new followers I wanted to mention this week. At Geek Chic Daily, TOMIWXI, Top Gear Auto Live, Ask Hendo, BD Kuyman, and Binge Wars are the new followers. So thanks for the follows there, guys.
Oh, is Hendersonville, North Carolina not following us anymore?
No, that's Ask Hendo.
Oh, okay, good. Because I mentioned Hendersonville, and they just automatically followed me, so I thought that was pretty sweet.
Awesome. It's like that RoboCop bot, Twitter bot, where anytime you mention RoboCop, it says, I'd buy that for a dollar.
Yeah. Constantly in contact with the RoboCop spam bot.
Yeah. So we're also on iTunes, so you guys can subscribe to the podcast for free there. We do have an email I wanted to mention, or two emails, actually, real quick. So this one is from a plethora of women. Hi, Ben and Tyler. We have a question. A man who goes by two names, Henry and Edward, hint, an English doctor. I have no idea what this has to do with our podcast or anything, but can you guys answer this question? Patches, can you think of a man who goes by two names, Henry and Edward? It's
Wait, what was the full question again?
That's all that's written. It's just, can you name a man who goes by two names, Henry and Edward?
Think of famous book by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Wow, as if that wasn't enough to give it away.
Henry and Edward. Is this some sort of Twilight reference that I don't understand?
No, Robert Louis Stevenson. It's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is the answer. Like a random trivia.
Now I feel really underread.
Trivia question. Well, to be fair, I didn't know that answer either. They wrote the answer at the bottom of their email, so that kind of helps us out here. So.
It's okay. There's probably going to be a Twilight movie about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde after this new one comes out, so you don't have to worry about it.
They also give us a bunch of suggestions of movies. I'll read a couple of them. They want us to watch Snow White, A Little Princess, Escape to Witch Mountain, The Aviator, Heavenly Bodies, Splash, and The Nines, which they say requires intelligence, which came out in 2007. Ooh. It's actually a really good movie. If you guys haven't seen that one, check it out.
I think they're insulting us.
I think they, well, maybe. We'll see.
We got their trivia question wrong, so it's valid.
Yeah, and that is from Leah, Ashley, Yuri, Libby, Sam, and Christy. So thanks for the email. And then the other one that I wanted to read is actually pretty fascinating. It's a longer one, so I apologize, Patches. But it's about The Towering Inferno, and we did a really interesting episode. It's probably like one of my favorite ones that we've done in the history of this podcast a few weeks ago. When we talked with Mike Eisenberg about The Towering Inferno, and we got an email from Jim Vines here, and I'll just read some of this, maybe not the whole thing, but we'll see. Here we go. Hi, Ben. I was so pleased to hear your fun, lively, intelligent discussion review of The Towering Inferno. I think it's unbelievably cool for, I'm assuming, 20-somethings, such as you and your co-host, to have an in-depth conversation about a movie that was released way back in 1974. However, I'm somewhat disappointed that one of you fellas, forgive me for not recalling his name, had to watch the movie on a tiny screen while driving. Arg, sacrilege. That would be Mike. Believe me, Inferno looks great on the big screen. When I was 11, the movie came out. I remember well seeing it in the theaters. Quite an experience. I assure you, I've seen the movie two more times on the big screen in just the last few years, including a near packed house at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. So that's interesting for people in LA. Try to check that out if they do any more screenings over there. And he says, and the movie still holds up. So he says, in 1975, the year after Inferno was released, I met producer Irwin Allen. He was a good friend of my then best friend. Mr. Allen discovered I was a young filmmaker and invited my friend and I to watch him film some of the other movies he produced in the few years after Inferno was released. None were anywhere near as good as Inferno or The Poseidon Adventure. He disagrees with our assertion that the movie could have worked just as well in 90 minutes. There's a movie that big with that many stories and characters and scope needs to be over 2 hours. It's important for the audience to feel like they've been through something, through a big event. and says that a few little further tidbits. There was absolutely no CGI in Towering Inferno. That building was a 70-foot model. 4 or 5-story section of the building was also built for some of the close-up scenes when McQueen and the firemen got atop the scenic elevator. The opening shot with the helicopter approaching the building was a matte painting incorporated into a real shot of the San Francisco skyline. So I think at one point during that episode, I said that there was like digital effects going on, and that's actually what it was, just a matte painting. He says at the end, by the way, this film was instrumental in tall buildings having to install fire sprinklers, something producer Irwin Allen was very proud of. So anyway, I really, really enjoyed your podcast. We'll certainly recommend it to other fans of The Towering Inferno. Keep up the great work. Jim Vines from L.A. So thanks for the email, Jim. Padges, have you had a chance to see The Towering Inferno?
I actually watched it over Thanksgiving last year.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was kind of boring, but maybe that's just my problem. I don't know. I was also full.
It was the tryptophan.
Not a fair. And anything you watch over Thanksgiving, you must watch again for actual insight. Because
yeah,
I had like mashed potatoes coming out of my eyes, so I don't know.
Nice. All right.
Yeah, I thought it was gonna be boring too, but I ended up liking it. Just I don't know. It reminded me of, for some reason, it reminded me of like the
Burning Building.
Well, yeah, that and 2001 A Space Odyssey, for whatever reason, like just kind of a spanning film. I don't know why it kept reminding me of that, but it had nothing really to do with Space Odyssey at all.
So
but I also thought it was going to be boring.
Let's finish up the character name game, and this one's going to be tough. So the character's name was Vince Howard, and now it's a TV show, not a movie, so I apologize for doing this to you guys. Do you have any idea what TV show Vince Howard was from? I'll give you a hint. It's
I only have one guess.
No longer on the air. Go ahead, Patches.
I know that Chronicle, and the only person I know who's in the movie is Michael B. Jordan, and he was on The Wire, so I'm guessing that his character and I've never watched The Wire. But I'm only guessing that that's the character from The Wire.
Since Tyler, I'm guessing, will never get this.
Whoa. I was going to take a guess.
Okay, well, that's incorrect, Patches, but really, really close. Go ahead.
Damn.
I think it's The Shield, because I remember some guy named Vince was Chiklis's side guys in The Shield.
It is not The Shield. It is actually Friday Night Lights, which features Michael B. Jordan from Chronicle, which is out.
I didn't know he had another gig.
I've never seen The Wire either, and if I had, I probably would have listed him as the character from The Wire. So, yeah, all right.
I was so close. That was much closer than I ever anticipated. Anyway. Yeah,
definitely. All right,
Mackie and Vince Howard. You don't remember that episode, Ben?
No, I don't. I don't know.
They went and choked out a hooker at a strip club.
And yeah, he probably yelled, "Tell me what I want to know," and got like a crazy look in his eye, right?
Oh, don't start Chiklis Gate all over again, Ben.
All right, well, let's go around the circle and just tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet. Matt Patches, let's start with you.
Yes, I am the movies editor of Hollywood.com currently, so you can go to Hollywood.com to read many things that I produce for them, interviews and I don't know, bullshit, lots of things. And you can find me co-hosting another podcast called Operation Kino, which is hosted through cinemablend.com. And I co-host that with Katie Rich and Dave Gonzalez of Latino Review and David Ehrlich of movies.com. And we just shoot the shit. It's great.
It's a really great podcast. If you guys haven't heard that one, check out Operation Kino.
Thank you. And then I'm on
awesome
Twitter.
Beginning.
The what?
It's got an awesome beginning. Like, I just love the Op Kino, like, intro music where it's like...
Oh, yes. That is Dave Gonzalez's... his spinning. He's a disc spinner or something.
Awesome.
But, and then you can find me on Twitter at Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R Patches, P-A-T-C-H-E-S.
Nice. Tyler, let's go to you.
You can't find me anywhere. I'm on the show. That's about it.
Okay. Wow.
I'm in semi-retirement.
Okay. All right.
I've been going for far too long. I'm starting to burn out, Conan O'Brien style.
Respect that. Well, you guys can track me down at twitter.com/BenPears. You can find me writing at geektyrant.com, doing that daily video thing every day during the week. You can find my reviews at filmonic.com and a bunch of movie news and stuff there. I'm no longer employed at Paramount Pictures, where I've been working for the past year and a half, so I've got a lot more free time on my hands to write up movie news and stuff like that, so you can check that out at at Filmonic, and you can also find my reviews at notjustnewmovies.com, which is the namesake for this podcast. And then when we get around to doing them, you can hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast as well. So music for this episode comes courtesy of John Williams' Hook score, which is, as we said, pretty awesome. And yeah, that'll do it for us, guys. So thanks to Matt Patches for stopping by and hanging out. I appreciate it, sir.
Thank you.
And yeah, we will see you guys next week for They Call Me Mr. Tibbs.